Nick Ashew on the Fan. We got an Eastern Conference Game 7 tonight. We now have reports, according to ESPN, James Harden's going to get a multi-year deal with the Cavs, whatever happens tonight, so there's that. Cavs are going to lean all the way in on James Harden. Maybe they won't break that thing up. They could lose Game 7 tonight to the Pistons and then just go, you know what, let's just keep this thing together. Let's just work with what we've got. That's one way to look at it, right? I mean, look, James Harden could go off for 30 and 10, and the narrative is still going to be that he fades in the playoffs. And listen, some of it's true, right? He's got a reputation. It's hard to shake a reputation. It's like when people talk about, you saw it last week, right? Stephen A. and other people screaming about the Wizards being dysfunctional or they're a mess and no one should get. Dude, that was such an old narrative. You can tell when somebody checks out and then jumps back in and has something they've seen on the internet from 3 years ago and they're like, I'm just going to say the same thing that was said 3 years ago. It takes time to shake a reputation as a team, as a person, right? Everybody's got that friend. Does the same thing that, you know, going out too many nights a week, can't settle in on a relationship, and finally just says, you know, I want to change. Really want to start a family. I want to settle down. It's great. You hope you do, but we got to see the evidence. Show us a, you know, relationship for a couple years. You're serious about this. You're growing up a little bit. You're changing, evolving, whatever. You know, this is what it takes. James Harden to grow up in the postseason takes a lot more than a couple of games in the second round of the playoffs against the Pistons to really do it, but it'll help. I mean, if he struggles tonight, it's just going to be, well, that's what he always does. Again, game four, three straight clutch baskets helped him win that game. Game five, great game. I mean, put up 30. I mean, it was a big game for James Harden. Game six, had 8 turnovers. 23 points, not bad. Shot the ball okay, but wasn't a horrible game, but it wasn't great. The thing here is the Pistons are 4-0 in elimination games this playoffs. They're already down 3-1 to Orlando in the first round. They've already been in playoff mode for a while. So it makes them dangerous. So it makes them a team. It's why I trust the Pistons to win this game tonight. And now listen, the Cavs, this group, a lot more playoff experience than this Pistons group. So it kind of goes against the trend of, right, playoff experience tends to win, especially like early on as a team like the Pistons is making that rise. But the Pistons were in the playoffs last year. This might be that breakthrough moment for them, and I feel like it is. We're at that moment where it goes beyond the losing the second round to the get to that next level. It's always the second round for these teams. I don't know what it is. You just see it a lot. It's the second round, except for the Spurs. Spurs move on to the Western Conference Finals, and that's really it. But, you know, it's just hard to look at James Harden and see one game tonight and think that's going to change the reputation that's there. It's going to linger for a while. You give the guy credit, but, I mean, you had years of this. You go back to the Rockets. You look at, I mean, half the other stops, at this point, you're losing track of all the teams he's played for, the Clippers and the Nets and the Sixers, and it's like, geez, what's left? But the Cavs are an organization that has been trying to find success without LeBron James. That's really what it comes down to. Now, I don't know what that means with this report now from ESPN that the Cavs would be willing to give James Harden an extension, or, I mean, it'd be a new deal, basically, and, you know, what that means for LeBron, but I still think there's a chance LeBron finishes his career in Cleveland one more year. Just, it makes sense, but I like the Pistons tonight. I really do. I think this is a team that's playoff tested even more than the Cavs, and there's far less pressure on the Pistons too, right? Because if this is a spot the Wizards are in a year or two from now, right, it's going to be, well, the Wizards haven't done this. This would be the next step. Like, there wasn't pressure on the Wizards in the John Wall, Bradley Beal prime era in that short window when they were losing in the second round of the playoffs at first, right? It was like, oh, great team. They're on the rise. You got guys in there, you know, early to mid-20s here, and it's a younger team, and John Wall and Bradley Beal are going to really take this team, and the next step is Eastern Conference Finals, and then everything fell apart. Injuries just destroyed all that. But you have a certain point where you go from, hey, fun team that's wins a playoff series or wins a couple of playoff games, to now you got to actually start winning for real. And you've got to take that next step. I think that's where the Pistons are. And the Cavs have just kind of shown time and time again that they fold in these big moments, and it's going to be back in Detroit. Home court advantage will matter for the Pistons. I think Detroit wins that game and moves on, and we see a rested Knicks team sitting and just kind of waiting. All right, who are we going to play? Who are we going to see? Feels like the Knicks haven't played in a month. And they're going to see a Pistons team, or even a Cavs team if it goes that way. Both these teams, the Pistons and Cavs, have gone 7 games in their previous series. So they've had long playoff runs. And the Knicks, even though they were down 2-1 to start the series off against the Hawks, got out of that series, came back, won that. Then they go and they sweep the Sixers, and you go, okay, it's been a calmer road for them. They've also been really good. The Knicks are a team that bought a contender. Because they could go to the finals. They're just not going to beat the Thunder, or in some miracle, the Spurs win that series. They're not going to beat the Spurs. I give them a better chance against the Spurs. But both those teams just have, they're just tough matchups for the Knicks, and those, they're just better out west and well-coached. Look, the Knicks went out and traded a bunch, said F them picks in a lot of areas, and have some, I mean, really nobody on that roster. Mitchell Robinson, I guess, is like a homegrown guy for them. It's not much, right? A guy you drafted that stayed, it's not many. Most of them were free agents or trades. And sometimes it does work, but it's getting harder and harder to do that in the NBA. And if you do trade for a star, you got to give up a million draft picks. Although, what's the value of draft picks going to be when the lottery's all smoothed out in a year from now? So that'll be interesting to see, too, if teams value draft picks less because they're like, well, who cares? We can protect them, and it could fall anywhere, and it's just not going to be there's no guarantee of where it's going to be anyway. That would be interesting to see what the value of draft picks actually looks like. But, yeah, listen, Game 7 in general, who doesn't like a Game 7? Stanley Cup playoffs, NBA playoffs, you don't even have to be a fan. You know what's on the line. It's a winner-take-all game. That's what makes sports great. And the NBA is starting to get, I mean, these playoffs have just felt so much more competitive.
Do you think James Harden likes a Game 7?
I don't think James Harden likes anything. I think James Harden likes the offseason and likes just casual coasting through the regular season. And listen, this is one of the all-time great scorers in the NBA. I don't care if you like that he went to the free throw line 12 times a game in his prime or whatever. Dude put up 35 a game in one season. Like, I'm sorry. You are a talented scorer no matter what you're doing to be able to put up 35 points a game in an NBA season. You just are. But no, I do not think James Harden likes a Game 7. I think he's like, oh, can we stop playing so many games? I'm over it. And look, not everybody has the Mamba mentality, okay? Very few do. There's a reason why that's valued, why somebody that's that competitive like Kobe was, and you know, like anybody that's compared to Kobe now, it's like, do they have the mindset? It's not the game. It's not the physical attributes you bring on the court. It's also, what's the mental? How do you approach every day? That's what we're looking for. But I do think that this new generation of talent in the NBA looks at things very differently. Really, we're past the point now of the teaming up. Because if you look, the Anthony Edwards, let's just talk about American-born players. It's different, obviously, talking about a Luka or a Nikola Jokic or whoever who never came up in AAU. But even guys that are American-born players now that came up past the prime of like super teams, LeBron and Heat. Let's use that, the LeBron Heat, the Heatles. Let's use that as an example. Or Durant going to the Warriors, which just set everybody off, even though that Warriors team all drafted, right? The core was all guys they drafted. They just had the room and said, well, of course we're going to sign Kevin Durant. But you had that era where everybody was mad at the NBA and stars because they were constantly asking for trades, constantly teaming up with other stars. It just felt like everybody was, there was constant player movement. There was no rivalries. It just felt like one and dones in college basketball. All of these younger players now coming into the NBA saw that era, heard the criticism, and they're pushing against it. Listen, the rules in the NBA have changed some of that. There's no question. They've made it harder, and it's more enticing for guys to stay and re-sign with their current team because it's way more money in the contract you'll get there versus going somewhere else. The NBA's worked that out. But there's also a mindset with a lot of these players, I think, that's going to be, nah, man, I don't want to be in that category. That was a previous era in the NBA. It doesn't mean that players aren't going to still want to take control of their futures, their destinies, and where they live and where they are when they can. And there's nothing wrong with that. But it got out of control. I mean, Paul George re-signing with the Thunder and then in a year asking for a trade to the Clippers was like, what are we doing? And again, you can still do that now to a point, but it's harder to make those trades. The contracts are bigger. It's all the boring stuff that is involved with that. But the mindset of a lot of these younger guys now, it just feels different. It feels a lot more competitive. I mean, listen, the rebirth of the big is real, right? But there's also now the potential for that image of Chet Holmgren and Victor Wembanyama, two guys that should have been 6'5", that were stretched out to over 7 feet. They looked like they grew in 6 weeks, 5 inches. And they're just these scrawny, wacky, waving, inflatable arm flailing tube men that are out there banging elbows against each other for a 7-game series. That's going to be fun. I get it. It's not Hakeem Olajuwon and Patrick Ewing and Shaq and everybody else you want to look at as bigs in the 90s, but this is the new big. It's scrawny, lanky guys shooting threes from 30 feet out, but it's going to be a competitive series with those, and that's where these rivalries are starting to get. And Chet Holmgren doesn't like Victor Wembanyama. It's same both ways. They want to compete against each other, and I love it. I love it. That's what we need in the NBA. We need more of that. But you also have to have recurring, right? It's recurring series. Like, you're way more interested in a show you're watching if you had multiple seasons and there's tie overs from the previous episode and there's drama and there's you're going back and there's a bigger problem that has to be solved. Like, that's good writing, right? Well, this consider it writing. The writing in the NBA is we got a rivalry brewing out west in the Thunder and Spurs. Shai Gilgeous-Alexander was just named the NBA MVP again, back-to-back seasons now for him. And those teams are built to compete against each other for a long period of time. It's not like they were built and they've got contracts due in a couple of years and won't be able to keep the roster together, which is kind of what the Knicks are going to be facing soon. Karl-Anthony Towns' contract is going to be a thing. Like, that's what happens when you buy a team like that. There sometimes is a shorter window that you can put that together. Thunder and Spurs are going to be doing this for a while. So the question is, what does the East look like? And what are the Wizards going to be competing with over the next couple of seasons as they're growing and trying to get, you know, more involved with this? And again, there's going to be a lot of trade rumors that are going to be out there. There's going to be a lot of potential stars still on the move. And you're going to see maybe a Boston and an Orlando, or if Detroit or Cleveland loses this series, even if Harden's back in Cleveland, they still change things up and make a bunch of roster. I mean, there's a lot of that still on the table right now. But that being said, it does not feel like you have the East solidified. Even Boston, look, I know this is kind of a season that the Celtics were going to write off, and you realize, wait, we can play still. We can still compete in the East. And then Jason Tatum came back, and then you thought, well, they're up 3-1 in the first round. This should be good. Oh, never mind. So they just blew that. And I guess that's okay. All right, so the Celtics are going to probably be aggressive this offseason, look to make some changes. Is Jaylen Brown happy there? Does he want to get moved at some point? I mean, all of that's on the table right now. Not to mention everybody else. What are the Heat going to do? I mean, yeah, they're always aggressive in some way. I mean, the East is a lot more open. The East is a lot more open than where the West sits right now. But you're starting to see some stuff brew there too. And if the Knicks kind of stay where they are, Knicks Sixers will be a thing. And it's still there, but it's not to the level of what you got going on out in the West. Nick Ashew on The Fan. We're less than a week past the point where we found out the Wizards were going to get the number one overall pick. Still a little bit of a celebration, still a little bit of a high, you know. All that young, up-and-coming talent and building around it and saying, well, if you could just get that number one pick in the 2026 NBA draft. And here we are. Chase Hughes, Monumental Sports, jumps on with me now. I guess now, I know you've already been out there, you've watched workouts, Chase, you've seen a lot, but has it kind of set in at this point, like all the leading up to, all of the hype, all of the praying that the basketball gods would let the ping pong balls fall in the Wizards' favor? Has it settled in at least at this point, like, oh, we're talking about the number one pick for this team in a really loaded draft?
I'm almost all the way there. I still kind of remind myself, wow, the Wizards won the first overall pick. And, you know, not just getting the first pick, but in this draft, it seems just so fortuitous, so lucky for them, especially at this point in their rebuild, the way it could vault them forward. And now we just got to wait and see for a consensus to form on who will be the number one pick, because right now I think it's really up in the air.
And it does definitely feel up in the air. And, you know, listen, if you look at roster construction alone, it kind of feels like A.J. DeBonsa fits more with the Wizards. Darren Peterson fits a little bit more with the Jazz at the number two pick. I know there's workouts still in interviews. There's so much more to go with at this point. But, you know, just from you and just seeing these two players, seeing the roster, seeing where they fit, do you have a gut? Do you have just sort of a maybe if you were drafting the direction you would go? I know there's a lot of moving parts, but there is so much hype around these two guys that I kind of feel like either way you go is like both these guys deserve to be a number one overall pick.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, I think it's really close. I honestly think it's 50-50 at this point. At first, I thought it was DeBonsa. Obviously, he killed it at the combine, put up unbelievable measurement numbers. But the more I talk to people there, there were a lot of people who say that they think that the Wizards also like Peterson. So I think they're going to take their time to make this decision. You know, I would still give DeBonsa probably a slight edge. I mean, he's the number one pick on most mock drafts. And then you see what he did at the combine. And I always tell people through experience, like, don't make too much of vertical leap. Like, look at all the best players in the NBA nowadays. With the exception of Anthony Edwards, they don't play above the rim. They don't jump super high. Like, it's not the 80s or the 90s anymore. But when a guy is basically 6'9 without shoes and has a 42-inch vertical leap, I'm starting to think, like, how many players after LeBron and Wemby would you list as better, just like freak athletes that have gone into the draft this century? Like, I think he's in that conversation. So it's hard to imagine a team could pass on A.J. DeBonta, but this is the year where he might not even go number one.
Which is just, yeah, I mean, it just shows the level of talent that's here. All right, so obviously that's one advantage that DeBonta has, just the sheer athleticism alone. When you look at Darren Peterson, what's something that really stands out to you where you say, like, that would be massive for the Wizards?
His ability to be an offensive engine. I think DeBonta can do a lot off the dribble. I think his dribble package for his size is incredible. But I think Peterson profiles as a guy that you could run your offensive round as a lead guard. I don't think it's going to happen early on. He says he's more comfortable playing point guard, that he's always played point guard, that it wasn't until he got to Kansas where Bill Self put his hand on his shoulder and said, look, buddy, you're going to play the two to help us to win. But his ability to get past people off the dribble, shoot off the dribble from three, I think that does project long-term as a guy that you could run your offense through. Like, you know, maybe if the Wizards drafted him, it's Trae Young for a couple years. And then, you know, Darren Peterson is the heir apparent. He's just going to have to develop the point guard skills to play at the NBA level, you know, protecting the ball. He's got to improve his passing vision. His passing numbers were not great at Kansas last year. So I think that would be his biggest selling point. And related to that, just the first step, the way he can get past people so easily to break down the defense and the shooting threes off the dribble, those things are really enticing when you think of what plays in the NBA nowadays.
When you look at teams, you know, and specifically the Wizards, but, you know, the Jazz are in the spot too, and I kind of look at them with the top two picks since we're talking so much to DeBonta and Peterson here. Like, would you focus more on best player and talent, or would it be roster construction and best fit? You know what I mean? Because, like, DeBonta kind of fits a little bit more with what the Wizards have, but then there's the certain upsides that Darren Peterson has as well. Which direction would you lean if you had to weigh one of those?
Best player available, 1,000 times out of 1,000. Yeah. I think you have to play that game when you're picking this high in the draft. For Exhibit A, I'll point to Dylan Harper with the San Antonio Spurs right now. Bill Simmons and all the national media, they're talking about, oh, this guy could be a superstar. He could be first-team All-NBA. Okay, well, what if the Spurs were like, you know what? We like him, but we already have De'Aaron Fox and Stephon Castle. They wouldn't look very smart right now, although there were a few decent backup plans in that particular class. But I could go on, I could give you hours of examples of it going both ways. You know, Vlade Divac just recently said that one of the reasons why they passed on Luka Doncic was because they already had a point guard in 2018. They already had De'Aaron Fox. De'Aaron Fox is an All-NBA point guard. That was a franchise-changing, catastrophic mistake. The other end of it, the Golden State Warriors, when they drafted Steph Curry, they didn't need a scoring guard. Monte Ellis, I'm sure you remember him. You're a ball knower.
Oh, yeah.
He was a really good guard, about the same size as Steph Curry. They also had Jamal Crawford. I've looked this up recently, and they overlooked that and said, you know what, why don't we take a chance on the guy from Davidson who can make threes at a really high rate? And the result was a dynasty. So I'm not exaggerating. A lot of the biggest mistakes that have ever been made in NBA draft history, the most famous one is Sam Bowie over Michael Jordan when the Blazers thought they needed a center. It usually comes down to a team being too deferential to position over best player available.
God, I forgot Jamal Crawford was on that Warriors team, too. You're right. And I'm with you, by the way, Chase. I think best player available, especially when you're just trying to kind of build the core and figure out who's going to be there long term and who, you know, where their positions fit. I absolutely think that that's the right choice. Talking to Chase Hughes here, after one and two, DeBonta Peterson, it feels like the consensus is Cameron Boozer is going to be three, barring something crazy or a trade going to the Grizzlies at three. Cameron Boozer's got a really high floor, high basketball IQ. I mean, he's a 20-10 guy, great passer for a big as well. I think he's got a really high ceiling in the NBA, but, you know, a lot of the conversation becomes like, well, you know, he's not as athletic. I mean, there's some of the best players in the NBA, like you kind of pointed out earlier, Chase, not that athletic. I mean, Nikola Jokic is 7 foot with a dad bod, and he's running up and down the court like it's nothing. So it's like, I don't know, to me, I feel like that's such an overrated knock against Cameron Boozer. Where are you on that?
Oh, I agree. I mean, I go back and forth on him like I think everyone does. You know, the combine results were interesting, a little shorter than I expected, but a big wingspan. And I believe he had the best shuttle run of all the top prospects. So we were, you know, anyone who's watched him, I think a lot of people have pointed out, I don't know about the lateral quickness. Well, I mean, he proved at the combine in that drill that he can move pretty well laterally. You know, I think if he's to become a star at the next level, the shooting will have to translate. He was a really good shooter in college. I mean, among the top prospects in this draft, he is the most efficient player, right? I mean, he shot well over 50% from the field, 39% from three on four attempts per game. That's really good for a big man. And what impresses me is that he's 253 pounds, and he plays bully ball, but he's got just such soft touch around the rim. And I think that bodes really well, because what I was saying is, about guys not really having to have great vertical leaps and playing above the rim, you still have to score around the rim. It's very helpful if you can make threes. That's really important. And then you got to be able to get into the paint and score around the rim. And I think he's going to be able to do that without having to jump over people, because he'll just, you know, bump into them and then find an angle and with a nice touch shot or a floater or a hook shot, get it in. So I think he's got a higher ceiling than people give him credit for. It's really just a product of this draft where you're talking about him going third or fourth, because I think most other years he'd be talking first or second.
Now, in terms of fourth, the Chicago Bulls, does it feel like Caleb Wilson at this point? Could you see a surprise there at all? Again, all of this is pretending we're not talking about trades at this point either, which could really throw things out of whack.
I honestly think it's very possible that Wilson goes three. The Grizzlies, okay. I think a lot of people have made this point. They love athleticism and defense, and he's the best player of the top four if that's what you like. And if that was the case, then Boozer would fall to four where his father played. His father, of course, was Carlos Boozer, two-time All-Star, played for the Bulls. So that would be kind of cool. But I definitely would not discount some of the other guards. And, you know, I could list a bunch of them because there's really little separating them. But to pick one, I would say Darius Acuff. I think he could definitely go top five because, you know, once Peterson's shooting numbers dropped off in the second half of the season, Acuff just really surged to the end of the year and has a case as the best shooter in the draft. I mean, I think he shot like 44% from three, did it off the catch, off the dribble with a lot of focus from the defense. And, you know, John Calipari doesn't bat 1,000 in the draft, but he's put a lot of star guards into the NBA. And Acuff next. You know, you kind of got to retrain your brain and remember that Calipari doesn't coach in Kentucky anymore. It's at Arkansas. So if he recruits a guy and he's a guard and he's got skills like this, more often than not, that player turns into a really, really good NBA guard.
Is there anybody that you look at in this draft that you feel like could start to jump up draft boards and start to get a little more hype as we get closer?
Yeah, I mean, I'll give you two names. One that, you know, would be perhaps a big rise. That's Tunde Yusufu of Baylor. He's like fringe first and second round, but I don't buy it. I think he's going to go around the top 20. We'll see how many of these guys stay in the draft, by the way. There's a lot of uncertainty in that range. But he was a McDonald's All-American, one of the best athletes in the draft. People were comparing him to Anthony Edwards after the McDonald's All-American game because he was one of the more exciting players on the court. Really good defender, and there's questions about his offense, but he scored at Baylor. So I think there's a really high ceiling there, and he's got a great motor. And then another guy I would say is Kingston Flemings of Houston. Mm-hmm. He's a lock in the top 10, but I could see him moving up a few spots from where he's currently projected, which I think is the back end of the top 10, because he had a great combine. He shot the ball really well. He measured out a little bit taller than I thought he would at about 6'3 without shoes, 6'2.5 without shoes. And his first step was confirmed at the combine as being pretty special. Like, he is extremely fast. He plays defense very strong, kind of like a Cason Wallace. He said he models his defensive game after him. And you could just tell talking to him that he's going to interview well. He's very enthusiastic, very well-spoken, very humble. And so I've been enjoying watching him all year. I love physical defensive guards who can shoot and who have passing feel, and he checks off all those boxes.
What do you think the chances are we see a star moved before or during the drafts, like a Giannis, for example?
I think the chances are pretty good. At least with Giannis, it sounds like there's momentum there, right? We saw the report from ESPN. I really am just fascinated at how this offseason is going to go once the lottery odds are enacted, assuming they are. We've all seen the proposal. We've all weighed in on what we think about it. But what we don't know and what I personally foresee is a ton of domino effects in terms of trade value and also how teams operate this offseason. If you have no incentive to strip your team down to the studs to rebuild anymore, then that's going to change how teams go about the offseason and the types of players that they're interested in. Then first-round picks could take on a completely different level of value now that it's all you need to essentially do is be in the 16-team lottery, and you have a lottery ticket that could cash in with the number one overall pick. So how is that going to affect everything? It's going to be fascinating to watch. I think it's going to be a lot more profound in terms of what it changes than people are giving it credit for.
Yeah, we could have a wild NBA offseason. Chase Hughes, good to talk to you again, buddy. Thanks for coming on.
Absolutely, man. Let's do it again.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, you know how the NBA goes, right? It's kind of cyclical, and I feel like it's been way too quiet for way too long. And I feel like this offseason just has this, again, it's harder in free agency to build a team now. We know that the draft lottery is going to certainly be different moving forward, but man, you got some stars' names getting thrown around now, and you know, we'll see what happens in some of these playoff series too, or there are more changes there. I mean, there's a lot to certainly work with here that could cause a lot of movement around the draft, especially if a team decides, you know, I'd rather get another first round pick here and go younger. We've seen it before. You saw it in the NFL. You watched the Giants just do that. I mean, who knows if you'll see a team go that direction too. The Bucks could be in that spot. You got the 10th pick, and then you go another direction and get another earlier pick, and you move Giannis. So, all right, we'll see. We just had the NFL draft, and it's like now we get into the most hyped NBA draft for the next, you know, month plus or whatever that we get to lead up to that. I'm Nick Ashew. Well, we mentioned earlier that the Cavs are willing to give James Harden a new deal despite whatever happens tonight in Game 7, Pistons, Cavs. They also could apparently now be in the trade market. See, I'm telling you, man, the NBA is going to be... The Wizards might have an opening for Anthony Davis if he doesn't want to be there. I'm just telling you. Cleveland might face pressure to shop Mobley, Strus, or Allen if the team loses Game 7. So James Harden would stay, but Max Strus could get moved. And, you know, I mean, listen, you move one of your bigs, they probably won't move both, but Jared Allen maybe. I mean, these guys have been trade rumors for years, and they've tried to do this Twin Tower kind of setup, and it may just not work. But this Game 7's got a lot of different factors riding on it tonight. But apparently it's not going to matter for James Harden because the Cavs still want to give him a deal. He'll ask for a trade in a year anyway. I mean, what is the over-under on how many consecutive seasons James Harden plays for the Cavs before he asks for a trade? Now, I know he's getting older, so we're getting up against the clock here, but kind of feel like, do we put it at half a season? Does he ask for a trade by the next deadline again? Just kind of feels like that's going to be the point. They'll sign him to an extension, and then by the deadline next year, the Cavs aren't playing well, and they're like, let's move Harden. Send him to the Suns, Grizzlies, maybe. I mean, it's just, this Game 7 is, I mean, again, all of the different storylines with it tonight, and then we start the Western Conference Finals tomorrow in the NBA. It's a good stretch. Also, keep in mind, Giannis is going to be mentioned in all these two, and maybe it's the Cavs, maybe it's the Timberwolves, who apparently are going to be in the market. There's a bunch of different options for him there, too. I think Orlando's one of them. But it's just, you know, he's not back when Miles Turner, who's in his first year with the Bucks this year, remember, left the Pacers, who also are a team to think about in the Eastern Conference next year when Tyrese Halliburton's healthy again. Thank God they didn't get that lottery pick. I just wanted to see them lose that desperately because that was the ultimate tank job. But when Miles Turner goes on a podcast, the Game Recognized Game podcast with Breonna Stewart, basically just says Doc Rivers didn't find anybody ever, Miles Turner came out personally saying Giannis's name. Giannis is going to show up whenever he wants, really. I knew not to show up until an hour after they said the plane was taking off. I mean, just the dysfunction. To have somebody that comes from a winning organization, the Pacers were, right? Went to the finals last year, went to the Eastern Conference Finals the year before. Miles Turner signs in Milwaukee. They're like, oh, maybe this will make Giannis want to stay. And then Doc Rivers is there just letting guys do whatever the hell they wanted. Giannis is showing up late. Miles Turner's looking around going, what did I get myself into? Ron Burgundy in the bear cage. I immediately regret this decision. I mean, the check is nice, but a 32-50 team that was a complete disaster? That's what Miles Turner walked into and literally calls Giannis out by name. When you call the franchise player out by name when you're the new guy there, that tells you, you know, either I'm not back or he's not back. And honestly, if I'm Miles Turner, I'm probably doing that too. I'm pissing off the organization enough where I can just be like, trade me. Get me somewhere else. Anthony Davis for Miles Turner. How about that? I'd do it. Stretch the floor, play more games. I'd make that trade. Again, Anthony Davis at his peak, we know. But, you know, we're starting to get to the point now. What is he, 33? I mean, it's getting harder. But, yeah, look, there's no way Giannis is back in Milwaukee. And there's a certain point where guys just wear out their welcome a little bit too. They do. You get to that level where you just realize that the relationship is not working anymore. And ever since the Bucks won the title, it's never been the same there in Milwaukee. They tried Dame Lillard. That didn't work. I kind of thought that would work in terms of the way that they play. Like, it just never clicked. Damian Lillard wasn't happy there. He was mentally checked out. I think he was going through a divorce too. Like, that's just tough. Like, this is never, that was never going to work. But I mean, this whole weird relationship that Giannis had with the Bucks this year, and he's calling him out for not letting him play, and they say he's not healthy, and he says he's healthy. It's just like, this is done. He's moved on. But that could disrupt a lot in the draft. I mean, there could be a team that's willing to move off of a lottery pick. Like, say the Nets. What if the Nets are like, sixth pick, this sucks. We don't want this. We'll trade for Giannis, and the Bucks say, well, we'll have the 10th pick and the 6th pick. We'll do what the Giants did in the NFL draft and have two picks in the top 10. You move on from there. I mean, those are the types of things now, because this is a really deep NBA draft, but there are going to be some teams that are disappointed because they fell, and they realize, you know what, we'd rather go in a different direction and just get ourselves a veteran, a win-now guy, as opposed to sitting here playing this game, because the Nets have a million young players. They all were terrible last year. They had like 5 first-round picks. They were all terrible. So it's just the Nets are a collection of randos. It really is. So that could be a team that you see that gets aggressive trading for a star this offseason. There's just going to be a lot of movement. This just has the feel of an NBA offseason where there's going to be some seismic shifts, especially because if you're looking and you're in the West, you see the Spurs and Thunder and say, that's going to be a team we're going to be dealing with for a while. Like, we're going to be dealing with the Spurs and Thunder for a significant amount of time. And who in the West can compete with them without doing something drastic? The Nuggets? No. They keep losing in the first round now. The Lakers, I mean, is it Luka and Austin Reeves and LeBron leaves? They're going to try to build it more like a team. But
do you think there's a team in the West that if Giannis goes to this offseason becomes a competitor to those two teams?
Well, it depends on who you're taking away, because my first thought would be the Nuggets, but the Nuggets are going to have to give up. I mean, who are they going to give up on their roster? Well,
maybe Murray or something, because I think he's gone.
Yeah, I mean, if it's Jamal Murray, maybe, but then you're losing that shooting. And I know he's been hit or miss in the playoffs, too, like James Harden. But
I don't think Giannis Jokic is a great combo anyway. I don't think those are two big men that would work great together.
Right, so. and that's sort of, like, from a talent perspective, it's there, but you're going to have the chemistry. They kind of have they both kind of need to be sometimes even on the ball. You're going to have a rim protector, though, in Giannis. He's a better rim protector. Jokic does nothing there at all.
What do you think with Devin Booker?
And the Suns?
Yeah.
Wait, Devin Booker, you're saying Giannis on the Suns?
If he goes down to Phoenix, let's say he went to Phoenix instead.
This is a Phoenix guy right here.
I love Phoenix.
I think they're better. The Suns are definitely better, but I don't think they compete with... The Spurs and Thunder are just so deep, too.
Yeah.
So you got to have second units that can compete with their second units. So I find it really hard to find anybody. I mean, what are the Warriors going to do? Try to squeeze out more from Steph and trade for Giannis and have Jimmy Butler. And I just don't even see that working. It really feels like we're going to be dealing with those two teams for quite a while. I mean, we really will. And listen, teams are going to be aggressive. They're not going to sit back and be like, well, see in 5 years, this is done. I mean, you have to make an effort to build a team. It's just tough. It's tough to compete with what they've got there. But again, the NBAs can have surprises at any moment. And we may be getting quite a bit of that this offseason, too. But the Cavs, look, teams that are going to be in trademark. I mean, if the Cavs decide they want to move one of their bigs, the Nuggets need a big. What if Jared Allen goes to Denver? That adds a rim protector that they didn't have before. So that kind of plays off of what Jokic does offensively but lacks defensively. And maybe there's that. Minnesota is going to try to find somebody. It might be Giannis paired with Anthony Edwards. That's a better team, especially a team that's been to the Western Conference Finals a couple of years now. Maybe that's the direction that they go, but it's going to be tough because the Thunder and Spurs are only going to get better. It's going to be real difficult. Nick Ashew on the Fan. Nick Ashew on the Fan, and SI is stupid. Just want to point that out. They predicted the NFC East after the schedules came out. Again, this is why I'm falling into the trap, and this is going to happen. But they picked the Cowboys to win the NFC East at 10-7, the Eagles to go 8-9, the Giants to go 7-10, and the Commanders to go 5-12 again. Are you out of your mind? Are you out of your mind? Look, I think the NFC East is wide open. But by wide open, I mean reasonably wide open. And it also includes the Commanders winning more than 5 games. Let's go back and look at what they were able to do when Jaden Daniels was healthy. Now, if you're banking on Jaden Daniels getting hurt and there's 5-12 again, okay, then I guess that's maybe a reasonable prediction here. But to have the Cowboys at 10-7 winning the division, and the Eagles, it pains me to say this, but like that's a better team than 8-9. I know their offense is a mess.
I thought that was wild too.
Metal Chris, that's insane. It is. I'm sorry. That Eagles defense is still elite, and we saw what they were able to do last year with an offense that was at probably the worst form it's ever been. They've now added a new offensive coordinator. It's going to be a slightly new system. And listen, I'll even make the argument, and there's nothing to back this up, but I'll make the argument that Jalen Hurts is going to be somebody that's going to try to adapt more to the offense and try to be less rigid because he got called out in the media, and clearly the team leaked it to try and make him the scapegoat. So he's going to be trying to be a little bit more fluid like water and make sure that he's a quarterback that's working more with the coordinators and offense, like all of this. I mean, 8-9, come on. I can understand that the only one that I think it's reasonable is the Giants at 7-10. The Giants could finish last in the division at 7-10 because that's still raised from last year. You have John Harbaugh and you got a younger team, but you see them taking that next step. There, you can't tell me the Commanders at 5-12 is a reasonable. That's somebody looking at the team and thinking it's the same organization as before. I just, no way. Again, injuries are different, but that's a different story.
They also have so it's not just Sports Illustrated. It is the writer Gilberto Manzano, so mm-hmm. They'll probably have other people put their takes out also. So I don't want to say it's just Sports Illustrated, but they also have the Cowboys winning the division with just 10 wins, which
right.
is, like, I don't know who's going to win the division, but I think it's going to take more than 10 wins. It's not an easy division.
This is probably the worst prediction out of all of them. They've got the NFC North with the Giants going 12-5. This is a team that missed the playoffs last year, so I'm already out on these predictions. Bears at 11-6, Vikings 9-8, Packers 8-9. I mean, you could go either way with that. That's a pretty competitive division. That's fine. But that's if Kyler Murray plays well. They have the NFC South, Saints winning at 10-7, Bucks 9-8. I mean, that's a division that's always all over the place. Falcons at 5-12, okay. NFC West, the most competitive division in the NFL. This writer for Sports Illustrated, Rams 13-4, Seahawks 12-5, 49ers 8-9, Cardinals 3-14. I think the 49ers are better than an 8-win team. And they won 12 games last year. But I get that they didn't really do much this offseason and they've gotten older, but they were one of the best offenses in the NFL when Brock Purdy was healthy. And that's where they go in the NFC. I think these predictions are out of control, and I think it's to get the reaction that it exactly got from me. Just that. Cowboys at 10-7 winning the division and the Eagles going 8-9 and the Commanders 5-12. Three of those four predictions are stupid. They're completely off base. Giants at 7-10 feels fair. Now, I get it. These teams each see each other twice, so it's where are some of these wins and losses going to come from. But now I could see a team like the Eagles winning 11 games and winning the division, the Cowboys winning 9 and the Commanders winning 8. That would be more reasonable. With the Giants at 7, and it's more of a flattened type of division where everybody's in the race down to the last week of the regular season. But you just, I don't see that much regression with the Eagles because they are still so good defensively. Now, the one thing that would hurt them the most is not just Jalen Hurts in that offense, but it's also Saquon Barkley, because one of the big reasons why they won that Super Bowl and they were a team that was in contention and dominated the Commanders in the NFC Championship game was because of Saquon Barkley. Now, the Super Bowl, not as much. That was the defense, though, and they got after Patrick Mahomes and made his life hell. And I know that was a year ago, and it's not the same roster, and it's not the same defense, but we saw what the Eagles' defense was able to do last year and at least gave them a chance in their wild card game before they lost. That's crazy to me. Crazy to me to think that you'd look at the Eagles and think that that's an 8-9 team. Like, I don't want to say nice things about the Eagles, but I got to be honest here. That is a team that is better than 8-9. And I'm sorry, Lions at 12-5. The Lions lost both their coordinators and missed the playoffs. What gives us the reason to think that the Lions are going to improve by four wins this year? What were they, 8-9 last year, right? Yeah, they were 8-9.
Yeah, they missed the playoffs, I remember.
Yeah, they missed the playoffs, but it was 8-9. You can't tell me that you look at the Lions as a team that's going to improve by four wins. I don't see it, and I also don't think the Saints are a 10-win team. With who at quarterback? I mean, it's just, this is so far off base. All right, we got a weird sliver coming up for like 5 minutes next. Nick Ashew on the Fan. Got Nats Orioles coverage coming up next. Nick Ashew on the Fan for like a weird 4 minutes here. Hey. Home win streak for the Nats right now, sitting back at 500, 23-23. Maybe they're going to be the next conversation we have about rebuild starting to trend up in the right direction. Kind of feels like the rebuild of the rebuild a little bit, but hey, beat the Orioles a couple games here now, 13-3 win in second game of the series. It feels pretty good, you know? A lot of fans showing up to the game. Listen, we talk about rivalries in the NBA starting to expand. I mean, at some point, Orioles-Nats would be nice if it was a real rivalry. I mean, you know, there's a regional rivalry to it. There's fan bases that kind of feel it. But, like, in terms of the teams, you're still at that point where you got to get that. You got to have those meaningful playoff games, which means, well, there's only one way to do that, and that's meeting in a World Series. And I know it's not easy to get to that point. But if you're both teams that are competing for a World Series and you play in regular season, it happens. It's just the one thing I'll say is, you know, that it feels like a million years ago when the Nats won that World Series. But they've still had their eyes on a rebuild that has just carried on year after year after year. And this is starting to feel like a team that's got something and they're turning that corner, you know? I think there's a big difference there. We got a Game 7 tonight coming up, too, in the NBA playoffs. Pistons-Cavs, chance of the Pistons. I think the Pistons move on. There's a chance there for the Cavs, obviously, to win this and kind of save the roster they've got constructed, because it looks like James Harden's going to get offered a new deal, but they may move some other guys. There's a certain point where if you keep losing in the second round of the playoffs, it's only so much you can do. Maybe it's Giannis. I mean, Giannis has been thrown around about, you know, maybe the Cavs being interested, the Timberwolves, the Magic are thrown in there. And, I mean, you just start, again, what if the Warriors decide they want to do it? I mean, it just gets to a point now where Giannis is going to be the guy that moves the needle for a lot of different teams and a lot of different organizations, and they're going to try to get into the sweepstakes. And if it's too pricey or they don't want to actually pull the trigger on it, then who's next? And what's the next conversation? Look, I'm just telling you, I think there's going to be a market for Anthony Davis if the Wizards decide, yeah, he doesn't want to be here, we're going to move on and get somebody in here that wants to be here. Do not be surprised if Anthony Davis actually gets more in the trade market, if they were to trade him, than what you're expecting. Because the Wizards did give up multiple first-round picks. They were late-round picks. There was, you know, it wasn't like they were top three picks in this draft, but this draft, everybody was protecting their draft capital. Now moving forward, especially with lottery picks maybe not being having as much value because the odds are going to be smoothed out and the NBA is going to do all this crazy stuff where they're moving things around, you maybe see teams more willing to trade draft picks and move them around. And if the Wizards are getting them farther down the road and it's from a team that maybe bottoms out after a couple of seasons, then you're in the position where the Thunder are, where you get picks that have more value down the road because they weren't looked at as that way. I mean, there's a million different things that could happen here. But I think we're going to see that in the NBA. You're going to see a lot of teams considering making moves that they weren't before this offseason because Giannis is available. There's a trickle-down effect with other draft picks, where people landed in the draft, where teams were. I think there's a bunch here. I mean, and the Wizards could be involved in a lot of this. And they could even get into a position where they're absorbing a bigger contract for a season, and they're getting a first-round pick attached to it. Those are the type. There's a lot of wiggle room for the Wizards on top of having control of the number one overall pick. Now, I'm curious to see how this Jazz trade rumor actually evolves as time goes on and if they're really serious about it, because it's lying season, we believe very little. But if you're the Jazz and you really want AJ Tabonsa, you're gonna have to pay up, and that's really what the Wizards do. It would be really funny too if you're the Wizards, you just like make it seem like you're gonna take Tabonsa at all costs, right, till the last second, and then all of a sudden they're like, no, we wanted Darren Peterson, but the Jazz didn't trade up, so whatever, we tried, but we'd rather go Darren Peterson. They don't even draft him anyway. But yeah, look, there's a lot of time for this, a lot of moving parts, but rebuilds are very, very intricate, but you got to commit. And the Wizards have certainly done that. All right, Nats Orioles coverage coming up next. Nats sitting at 500, 23-23, up against the Orioles. And a lot of Orioles fans, a lot of Nats fans together. Let's turn this into a rivalry, right? All right, Nick Ashew on the Fan.